So I think everybody here has met me before. I'm Avery, filling in for Niyash. Okay, so integral systems continue. Right. So like I said, I assume you've seen canonical transformations before. Suffice to say that they give us some way to take a system described by coordinates Q and momentum P and rewrite them in terms of some other sort of coordinates, big QI, and associated momentum. Okay, canonical transformation. And our interest today is that if we're allowed to rewrite the problem with whatever coordinates we want, maybe we can imagine making this particularly simple. Can we choose coordinates, which I'm going to write in sort of a suggestive form, theta I and j I. Okay, such that effectively our equations of motion become trivial. All right, this is just Ji and Ji is equal to zero. Okay, in other words, can we write them in a form where our momenta are essentially all exactly conserved? And we're left with only a set of phase variables, which, since these are all conserved, are necessarily given by some theta I are equal to theta I dot, which are constant, plus a time, plus some phase. All right. In other words, can we take a complicated problem and make it trivial? I get a bunch of linear problems. If we can, these are called action angle variables. Okay, so these guys are the angles. These are the actions. And like I said, it makes everything trivial. You're familiar with a number of examples of this, right? So a free particle in three dimensions, right? We have three momenta, which are all conserved. We all know the answer. Things go straight. Okay, so this is not terribly surprising. For compact systems, okay, so for systems in which the motion is bounded, so not a free particle floating around, but systems in which stuff has to always remain in some size box, then these guys have to be bounded. Okay, theta are bounded, or the motion is bounded, I should say. Motion's bounded, let's just say that. And these guys take on the form of some phase, hence the name angles. And conventionally, the theta I are assumed to be from 0 to 2 pi. That is to say, bounded and therefore periodic. Okay. So a free particle can keep going forever, but if it lived in a box, it would have to be moving around. If I were to draw this kind of system in phase space in my original coordinates. Okay, so remember phase space. It's got my physical coordinate on one side, and my momentum in the vertical axis. These would execute some sort of cyclic motion, periodic motion. Okay. And if it's in 1D, it looks like a proper circle. If I try to look at it in more dimensions, right? So in this case, My theta I is describing my motion around the circle, and my j is describing the location of this in the phase space. If I were to look at it in higher dimensions, say two dimensions, some subset of the motion, so eliminating one of the parameters, would look like potentially a torus. And so I have one angle going around that way, and I have the other angle going around that way, and my motion in this phase space looks like something that's going around my torus. Okay? So some higher dimensional analog of just going around in one circle. Okay. Of course, life isn't that easy. The problem of actually finding your action angle variables is equivalent to the problem of solving your Hamiltonian system of equations. There are a couple things that simplify the process just a little bit. Okay, and the first is effectively Liouville's theorem. Okay, so Liouville's theorem is stated in a number of different ways. One is preservation or conservation of phase space volume. Okay, so that's usually the way that's certainly the way that I originally had seen it. The idea that as a system evolves, it always occupies the same volume in phase space. That volume gets messed up, stretched out, pulled in all kinds of directions, but it's always the same volume. But another way to state it is that the volume occupied by a system in phase space is independent of the particular coordinates you chose. Okay, so that's one way to state it. But another way to state it is that dqi, dpi, okay, the product over all your dimensions, your phase space volume element, is independent of your particular coordinates. Okay? And these two ideas are very closely related. If I were to integrate this left-hand side, integrate the right-hand side, I would get a statement about the volume being fixed. Okay? And that turns out to translate exactly into this conservation of phase space volume under evolution. The nice thing about the Liouville's theorem in this context is it gives us a natural definition for our action variables. If I needed to specify this orbit, right? Again, my angle tells me where I am. That goes around the orbit. But if every system's phase space volume is uniquely defined, the volume enclosed by that orbit is also uniquely defined. And that gives me a notion of something that's independent of the coordinates I choose. Okay? And this is exactly right. Okay, so the action, and you can think of this as is the volume or the area in our 1D case, or volume larger case, of closed orbit. Okay, and if we were going to make that mathematically explicit, I shouldn't say that this is related to this. This is equal to 2 pi or integral d theta j, which is just 2 pi integral dj. Just 2 pi. And we want to do this in multiple dimensions. Everybody gets a subscript. And that's something that's going to be independent of the specific coordinates that I've chosen and is defined all the time.
I'm sorry, what's GA
So J is the thing, the canonical momentum associated with our angle. Okay? And importantly, it's the thing that's conserved. We'll do one example in a little detail, and I'll just write down another example. But
that's ji dot.
Yep, ji dot. Thank you. Good. People are awake. Ji dot equals zero. That's right. So it's constant. Okay. Because this is independent of the frame and of the particular coordinates that I've chosen to write my system down in, I can also evaluate this in terms of my original coordinates, the ones that I actually wrote the problem down in. Okay, and that allows me to specify these action angles automatically, directly, action variables directly. Okay. So ji 1 over 2 pi. What? What is the hypothesis for Liouville's theorem? So Liouville's, the statement of Liouville's theorem is that phase space volume, the system occupied in phase space, is the volume occupied in phase space by a system is preserved under canonical transformations. And one of those is evolution. So that's the definition, or that's the statement of Liouville's theorem. And we normally think of it only in the restricted sense that the system evolves, and as the system's evolving, it's occupying the same volume in phase space.
So one the canonical transformation is evolution.
Yeah.
Evolution
in time, right? So
yeah, I know, but evolve the system evolves in time under certain conditions.
Yeah. Well, according to the Hamilton's equations. In our case, this is the main statement. This is the statement that we want. We just want to say that the phase, effectively the volume in phase space, is independent. As long as we've chosen canonical variables, as long as our Qs and Ps are related in the way that they have to be related for Hamilton's equations, then the volume element is independent of a canonical transformation. So this is also equal to, for example, the one we used, d theta I d j I.
But if you always can define j I,
Not necessarily. And so we'll get to that in a moment. We'll get to the robustness of this statement in a moment. Okay? But here, let's write down what they are so we can evaluate this in whatever coordinates we prefer. The QI. Let's see. Yep. PI DQI. Where do we want to evaluate this? We want to evaluate this over the same range that we evaluated this over. This integral was done over one period, or over the periodicity of the system. Okay, and this guy, we can do the first one trivially. It's going to depend upon QI as a consequence of whatever solution we have to the equations of motion. And this looks like this. Okay, so if you give me a solution, which is why we didn't get anything for free, we can evaluate exactly what the action variable is. Then we could turn around and solve for the dynamics of the system, but I didn't give you anything for free. You still needed to come with a solution first, right? So this is an integral around the orbit, and we still need to know what the solution is.
What would be an orbit for a free particle?
I think the action, well, this statement here, where we're talking about, yeah, right, it's not a bounded system. It doesn't have an orbit. So let's do an example of something that is bounded and has an orbit. Let's do a harmonic oscillator. It's everybody's favorite example. Harmonic oscillator. Okay, so.
Excuse me, how did you get from, how did you get the last inequality? With dpi dqi?
Mm-hmm.
Is equal to integral over the orbit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So this integral is over the path our system takes in phase space. Okay, so effectively I just did the integral over p directly. I've got p as a function of q, right? They're independent at this stage. P is a function of q now because we're having to sit on the orbit. So let's apply this in an example of a harmonic oscillator. And this is a great example to trip up your professors with at some point. I think there's a small chance I have my job here because I tripped up a bunch of professors at Guelph on this exact question at one point. In front of the students, they thought that must have been a great learning opportunity. Okay, so harmonic oscillator. H. Now we could, be proper theoretical physicists and assume that M and omega is one, but let's not. Let's make it fun. Okay. So I know what the solutions. We can write down Hamilton's equations right off. Okay. So Q dot is equal to dHdP plus P. Okay. By M. There we are. And we have P dot minus dH by Q. Okay. So that's equal to minus M omega squared Q. All right. And even I can solve those. All right. Differentiate that again. Plug it in here. Follow your M's. So even I can solve that. And the answer is Q is some constant times omega t plus some phase. And correspondingly p, which is just mq dot, is m omega a cosine omega t plus phi. Okay. We're all on board, right? Nothing funny has happened. So now let's use this statement down here, this definition, now that we've solved our system. Get an action variable out. Okay, so J, 1 over 2 pi, integral over one complete period of the system, one complete oscillation. Sure, certainly it is oscillatory like we had advertised before. Okay, of P and Q. Okay, so that's 1 over 2 pi. Well, P, if I wanted to rewrite this in terms of Q, it's just m omega square root of a squared minus q squared. That's a cosine and not a sine, so I've got to do something there. And we just have to make sure we're careful about taking the right roots, the right branches of the radical. So this looks like this, times an integral around one cycle of a squared minus q squared dq. And you can go ahead and do that, and you just get that this thing is pi. Pi times a. that right? Yeah. Why do I want to make, no, pi times a squared. There we go. Ha-ha. Got there in the end, right. Pull an a out, 1 minus q squared dq from 0 amplitude 1. Yes, right, pi a squared. So then this guy is 1 half m omega a squared. That's almost what you would have guessed, right? I mean, we know certainly this thing is going to be a constant of the motion. Sure enough, it looks like the energy, but it's not. It's very close to the energy. It's the energy by omega. And that's the thing where you'll slip up a bunch of professors. So if you ask them, if I have a harmonic oscillator, like a pendulum, I have my, it's on a mass on a string through a hole in the table, and it's swinging back and forth, approximate harmonic oscillator, I pull the string up, what happens? And, you know, then they start trying to come up with arguments about why the period or the amplitude stays the same and all of that. It's all wrong as you do it. It starts swinging violently because you're changing omega, so you're effectively changing E. You're putting energy into the system when you pull it up. So that's J. You can do it. Fun thing to do on a boring Saturday night. That's J. What about our angle? Again, we could have almost guessed. Okay, we had a conserved quantity, so it probably had to be related to that. What's our angle? You can almost guess again because we have an angle involved. But we don't have to go very far, because this thing implies that our Hamiltonian is just equal to omega j. All right, so that means that theta dot is equal to, this is still true, okay? Remember, this is going to be, you know, we're looking for our other quantity, our conjugate angle variable to our action variable. So this is just omega. So theta dot is equal to omega t plus phi. So you would have been exactly right if you just guessed that one. It's the only angle in the problem. If we wanted to write this in terms of q and p, which of course we must be able to do, theta is equal to that. Yeah, if it's a proper canonical transformation, this guy is just arctan, the way I've written it, of q by p. And I think that's it. There's an m omega in there. M omega q by p. There we go. Okay. And since this constant is not necessarily defined, we can give it some constant if we want. It doesn't really matter. Okay. So that's action angle variables for the harmonic oscillator. Any questions? It's a good example you can find in almost every textbook. You can do things like derive the pressure support from a population of sound waves and all kinds of stuff like that from this in trivial fashion. Okay.
So you're saying that even if the energy is not conserved, it's still a quantity.
Exactly. And that's going to become important in one more step. But that's exactly right. So let me give you a second example. I'm just going to write things down. Okay, so central potential. Now, the harmonic oscillator is nice because it's a one-dimensional example. We can easily visualize it. Clearly, it looks like something like this, right? We're watching something go around a phasor and a diagram in the phase space. And, very clear picture. central potential, we'll restrict ourselves to two dimensions. So now it's one dimension higher. Now our Hamiltonian looks like this. We have a radial bit. We have an angular momentum bit. And it's a central potential. So we have a spherically symmetric potential bit. Again, we have action variables that we can define once we have the dynamics. I'm not going to go through it in the same level. I'm just going to write down a couple interesting points that we should bear in mind and remember for the future. Minus p theta squared by 2m r squared minus v. Okay. So here we just substitute in an expression for p of r, using effectively the equations of motion, but really in the form of energy conservation. So if we knew what p theta was, we could perform this integral. We're going to know what that is in a moment. Suffice to say that this thing looks like p theta times some function of eccentricity. Okay, so if you're talking about a single particle's orbit in the Keplerian problem. Okay. So the first, this statement's of course general. This statement is true only for a Keplerian central potential. The point is that this guy is effectively related to the eccentricity. Okay. That's often an important fact in planetary evolution or planetary orbital evolution under perturbations. In fact, the eccentricity is effectively constant. The reason why I'm not too worried about what's going on with the angular momentum at the moment is the second action variable. It's just equal to the angular momentum. Okay, so the angular momentum is, of course, conserved through the orbit. So an orbit's defined when the whole thing goes around 2 pi. So here's an easy integral. That one's kind of hard. This one's easy. It's just equal to the angular momentum. And again, we could almost have guessed, at least this one, that we have two constants of the motion we might think about, and angular momentum is one of them. Why not? Finally, we have our angle variables, which are defined in essentially the same way as we did up there. We define some angular velocity okay. And these guys are necessarily constant, so we have something of the same form as before. Theta just becomes a linear function of time. Just as before, these angular frequencies can be just read off the physics of the problem. Here we had the angular velocity of the oscillation was what was related to the angle variable. This is just the epicyclic frequencies in our 2D problem. Okay, so you can go through it, but when you do so, what you'll find is that the angular velocity associated with this guy, the angular momentum, is just the theta epicyclic velocity. That's angular velocity. That's the what we'd call the Keplerian period of going around, and then the one in R would be the epicyclic frequency for perturbations in radius. And in the Keplerian problem, they're exactly the same. So it's very boring. In something that's not Keplerian, they can be different. Okay, and that's our two angular velocities and our two action angles then. One is going around in theta, the other one's going around in our radial direction. One full oscillation in radius. Okay, so that's largely a schematic picture, but it's worth keeping in mind because I get the feeling that Professor F. Shorty wants to give you all kinds of problems like this in the near future. Okay, one key thing. Now let's get to exactly your question. When can we fully define the system in terms of these action variables, action angle variables? Okay, so the statement is if we have enough exist, okay? If we have enough constants of the motion to fully describe the state, and fully describe the system, okay, then we would call this thing integrable. Okay. What that effectively means is we can completely solve for the evolution and the dynamics of the system in terms of what are essentially a number of algebraic relations. Right? That's what these guys are. There's no differential relations anymore in here. And that's what these guys are, angles that just increase linearly with time. Okay. In other words, this is simple. And of course, again, you all recognize this. You used to do this sort of thing all the time in freshman physics where, you know, you hardly ever solve F equals ma, you always apply energy conservation or angular momentum conservation and the like. Okay? All dynamics in these systems are really just the dynamics of these phases linearly growing in time. So it's essentially an algebraic system. So that's nice. When can you do that? Well, it turns out it's not quite generic, but it's close. And so let's talk a little bit about when you can. Kolmogorov, that's the hard one, Arnold Moser. Cam theorem. Okay? The purpose, or the point of the KAM theorem, the KAM theorem, is essentially integrability is robust. So what does that mean? Imagine that we have a Hamiltonian which is given by some initial Hamiltonian less, I don't like that one, we're going to make that lambda. It might show up as epsilon later on, but there we are. Hamiltonian is equal to the previous Hamiltonian, which is integrable, at some perturbation. And it's some perturbation that, of course, is writable in terms of our action angle variables because that's the variables that we're using to describe our system. Okay? So the KAM theorem says, so this is kind of the summary. Okay, maybe a slightly more involved summary is that any small perturbation of an integrable system gives another integrable system in the absence of resonances. Okay. And that's what I mean by saying integrability is robust. Small perturbation about an integrable system is itself integrable. So if I knew enough information to evolve H naught, I know enough information to evolve H, as long as I don't have any resonances. So what is a resonance? Okay. The absence of resonances. What is a resonance? A resonance is when we have omega I by omega j is related by some ratio of integers. Okay. For n and m element of natural numbers. Okay. All right. So that's what means to be a resonance. In fact, you can go further along. You can go further than this, and you can point out, or you can show that what you really need is not the absence of resonances. Okay, but to be sufficiently far. Flip them upside down. There we are. Lambda by n to the 5 halves. That doesn't really matter so much. Where the limit as lambda goes to 0, k of lambda equals 0. Okay? So, moreover, we don't really need resonances to be absent. If there are resonances, we can show that as long as we're sufficiently far from them, we're sufficiently far depends upon how big our perturbation is. And in the limit that our perturbation goes to zero, sufficiently far is infinitesimally close. Then we're okay. Say that again. So these are just these guys. So let's should I specify them? They are I, B, J, I, theta, I dot. Okay. So thank you. So a trivial example where we don't have a resonance would be the harmonic oscillator. There's no omega j, okay? We only have one frequency, there's no resonance. Someplace where we clearly do have resonances would be the Keplerian problem. We have two frequencies, and in the Keplerian problem, they're exactly the same, n and m are one. Okay, so clearly we have to worry a little bit. All right.
This is for 2D problems, right?
This is for n-dimensional problems. This is true in all dimensions.
I and J, you should
say. That's right. That's why these three guys are mathematicians, not physicists. You know, physicists would be satisfied with proving it up to like three dimensions. It takes a mathematician to care about infinite dimensionals. It's a fine thing. I'm glad they're there. Okay. So this tells us two things. First, integrability is robust. That was the main point. If we have an integrable system to begin with, we have one at the end. But the second thing it tells us is it's not generic. Clearly, integrability can fail. Clearly, we can be in situations where we don't have enough constants of the motion to fully define the dynamics of the system.
What is the k limit?
It's just some function that necessarily goes to zero. So it's telling us that we have to be close that's our definition of close. And if you really wanted to know for a specific system, people do go out and try to estimate exactly how big this is.
So, but k lambda can diverge. And we're saying that the absolute value of that is greater than that. Do you mean to ask that the other way?
To be integrable. So to be locally integrable, we want this. Yeah. When we're close to resonance, we're in trouble. When we're far from resonance, we're not. So moreover, to be integrable, we need to be bigger than that.
So in small,
that's right. That's right. Well, it depends on how what K looks like. And so you know, frequently what people will do, that these things are called KAM tongues. You'll look at resonances in a system, and around each resonance you'd see integrability break down. Okay, so you know, planetary orbits or something, everything is happily integrable far enough away, but as you get close to this resonance, it breaks down. And as the perturbations get worse and worse, then the swath of area where you're in trouble, you expands. So people draw plots as a function of lambda, show how fast you eat up all of your potential phase space. Let's do an example in a moment. One thing that this points out is that if I have a sufficiently slowly varying system, so imagine that I have some parameters in my Hamiltonian that are changing, like our frequency. We're pulling the string up through the table. Okay, I can expand my Hamiltonian in this way. I can say that my Hamiltonian is the original length of the string, original frequency, plus you know, the first Fourier series expansion associated with having changed the frequency. So there's a concrete example. We'll do another one in a moment. One of the key things is that as long as I'm changing slow enough, as long as lambda is small enough, these action variables are the same. That's why we're able to play this trick on physics professors and see if they can do that, figure that out. Okay. For that reason, so this is tightly, you know, closely related to why these are also called adiabatic invariants. Okay, so just let me just throw that in as a sidebar. So imagine we have H as a function of Q's and P's, or let's go straight to action variables. But then we also have some parameter that's changing. So this is equal to H theta J lambda naught plus lambda dot times delta t, or times t times a perturbation, which, let's just be specific, dH d lambda. Okay, as long as lambda dot's small enough, this thing is small, and we'd have Ji are invariant. Okay, because of this, they're also called adiabatic invariants. Okay, that is to say, something that doesn't change according to slow variations of the system. So that's a slightly stronger statement than what's being stated in the KAM theorem, but closely related. And again, you can look up your favorite classical mechanics textbook and find that there. Okay, so let's talk about an explicit example where we're starting to lose integrability. Okay. And you know, the classic example of this is our, you know, quintessential parametric resonance. I hope we've all done this. If you haven't, there's a lot of playgrounds nearby. Go try it out. Got a swing. Somebody's sitting on the swing. And you're holding on. And we're going back and forth. Okay? And as you go back and forth, you tuck your legs under, you push yourself down, and then you pull yourself out, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Effectively, what you're doing is we're pumping the motion of the swing, which I'm going to call Q, by changing our center of mass, going up and down. We should moving the center of mass. This is now a function of time. Okay? And so the Hamiltonian looks something like, this isn't exactly right, but this is the example that Professor F. Shorty left. But it's effectively the same exact situation. We just have to fiddle around with trigonometric identities to get there. It's our lambda, our small parameter, times A cosine 2 pi q plus B cosine 2 pi q minus t. Okay? And so this is where the changes in the height are showing up, and this is where our the swing. This is just, you know, like gravity, right? How high we are, how far you are off the ground. Okay. So if you didn't have the swing at all, if lambda were zero, we know the answer. It's fairly simple. In fact, we could have rewritten this as p squared plus this part, and that's perfectly integrable. It's this thing that's causing the trouble. And the phase space diagram of this sort of thing looks like, now, again, it's a one-dimensional thing, so this is simplified somewhat. Looks something like this. So we have some set of resonances, 1 to 1, 1 to 2, 0 to 1, okay? And around each of these, there's a couple 4 to 5s floating around. And around each one of these, we have a number of stable orbits. And something like this. This goes from 0 to 1. This goes from 0 to whatever maximum we've got here. And then we have interface. I've kind of over-exaggerated these guys. We have interface regions. Okay. And at some point we have unbound orbits that we don't actually get to on the playground, no matter how hard we try. And down in here, yeah, we have something that goes around like that, and then we have our what look like unbound orbits here as well. Okay?
I'm sorry, what's 1, 1, 2, 0, 1?
So these are points of resonance. So let's actually get a different color there. We have a I just needed a reference point to draw the points of resonance between the two different frequencies that we have, the frequency of the pumping, which is shown up over here, and the frequency of the, so that's the frequency of how fast we're moving around, and the frequency of the oscillation. Okay, and the key is that you start to see deviations from these nice smooth orbits in the dynamics. So you can construct these orbits when everything is small, but we start to see deviations from these at the boundaries. And so the normal picture is that we start to see some. Where did we start to see some chaotic behavior within some boundary of these phase space? But that chaotic behavior is locally defined. Okay, so we see orbits continue to be well defined within some regions, but we start to see chaos associated with local breakdowns of the KAM theorem. Okay, sometimes these guys are referred to as invariant tori. Okay, so those are regions where of bounded chaotic motion. Now one thing to point out is I'm trying to draw inherently a higher dimensional phase space thing here, but you know, we can't really do that on the chalkboard. And so just by way of a picture of a slice of phase space, you know, the way we should think about this is an example of a Poincaré section. Okay. The idea is, you know, imagine we have some subset of the phase space. And actually, let's draw it like this. And we have the system is evolving through orbits. Through the phase space. Okay. Poincaré section is the collection of these points where it crosses through. The subsection or the slice that we're looking at. Okay, so when we draw these pictures, what we're really doing is drawing, for a given system, we're really drawing this subset of points, just cut through the phase space. If you have a good way to draw high dimensional phase spaces, let me know. But okay, so swings give us an idea of it. It's just an explicit example of the KAM theorem, which is really a statement about the transition to chaotic motion, what happens when we start to see integrability break down.
So are there only these five resonance points?
I don't think so. I think there's an infinite number, but those are the only ones that I think we resolved in the picture. They're just examples. Okay. So now let's, so that's enough dynamics. So let's move on to physical systems. Okay, so one place that this is all going to find application is in gravitational dynamics. Okay. So astrophysics is, of course, filled with gravitating collections of objects, and it's clearly something that we would want to understand. Examples. Okay. Things like stars in globular clusters. So that's a nice simple example. We'll see a picture. Oh. Draw a picture of that. Galaxies. Okay, dark matter. Gas. And that's maybe a rather biased picture or a collection of possible things. You could add clusters of galaxies, groups of galaxies, all the way down to stars and planets. One thing that's commonly assumed is a smooth approximation, okay? Or you can also think of this as a continuum limit. Okay, what that means is I can treat whatever gravitating system I'm talking about as some sort of distribution either of stars in some probability space, or I can talk about it as some continuous distribution of matter. You know, obvious example would be the air in the room. Nobody would try to track all the molecules. We just assume it's some smooth distribution of stuff. Okay, this is justified because gravity is a long-range force. By the long range of gravity. It's usually longer than any of the other scales that are relevant for the constituents. Interstellar spacings, for example. Okay? I hope everyone has seen hydrodynamic equations before, but you know, an example for simple systems, continuum systems, that you certainly should see at some point in your life. So, hydrostatic equilibrium. Okay, this utilizes two equations. First, grad P is equal to minus rho G, which is rho grad phi, where phi is the gravitational potential. Okay, all this is doing is balancing pressure gradients against gravity. At least two of you know all about this because you were in the course last year, and this is essentially what we talked about for half a semester. And the Poisson equation. Okay. And you can put those together nicely. Just take the divergence of this guy and insert the Poisson equation on the other side. And it just gives us, after pulling a rho over here, 1 over rho grad. So P is equal to 4 pi g rho. Okay, and if I were to do this in spherical symmetry, this just looks like 1 over r squared d dr of r squared by rho dp by dr is 4 pi g rho. And we almost have a full, full definition of the configuration of whatever it is that's providing the pressure. Okay. The one thing we're lacking at this point is a relationship, and I should symmetry. The one thing we're lacking is a relationship between P and rho. There's a lot of potential, equations of state that we might consider, but that's a That's just a relationship between P and rho, and maybe T, and whatever other parameters you need to define your system, okay? But today, it'll just be between density and pressure. The most often used one, or the most often used in astrophysics, and so something you should be aware of at least, I've heard of before, are polytropes. Okay, and a polytrope, we say P is proportional to rho to some power. Okay, and frequently this is written in terms of something called a polytropic index. And it's just part of the vocabulary of astrophysics. A couple examples of where this would show up would be isothermal. So if I had a bunch of gas that was all one temperature, all one temperature. It was an ideal gas. P is nkT. N is proportional to the density. So P is proportional to density because temperature is constant. N is infinity. There's adiabatic. Adiabatic gas. So when I'm compressing the gas sufficiently rapidly that it's not transferring heat, and sufficiently slowly that it's not generating a bunch of internal motions, etc. Adiabatic, depending on whether it's non-relativistic. If it's non-relativistic, and it's 3/2, or P is proportional to rho to the 5/3. Okay? And if it's relativistic, N is 3. And P is proportional to rho to the 4/3. It turns out that this is also the result of degenerate matter. Okay, so when we have very, very dense matter and it's being held up by the Pauli exclusion principle, combined with the fact that we're making stars out of fermions, okay, Fermi-Dirac statistics, it turns out that these are also the same expressions. In terms of the polytropic index, M, you know, you can plug this in over here, and you can just ask, what power laws do I need? What's the power law relationship between the radius and the density? Now, I have to warn you that you have to be a little bit careful about that. You know, if you're going to really solve for some configuration of matter, there's all kinds of physical conditions that you have to satisfy. So, for example, you know, regularity at the origin, things like this, that are not generally satisfied by power's law of solutions to the equations of hydrostatic equilibrium. Nevertheless, it gives us some idea of how these quantities should vary. Okay, so in a regime where we're far from the center and far from the surface. So it gives us some idea of what we ought to be looking for. But just plugging these in and solving for a power law or self-similar solution gives mass going as radius, the 3 minus n over 1 minus n. Okay. All right, so then there's a couple examples that we might look at. And then we will call it a day. Okay, so one example might be a white dwarf. Okay, these are degenerate electrons. Okay, so this is the endpoint of a star like the Sun and lower mass stars. Core of held up by degenerate electron pressure is all that remains. Okay, and it's going to transition from something that looks like a non-relativistic degenerate electron gas to a relativistic degenerate electron gas. In the non-relativistic case, we have M is proportional to 3 minus 3/2, so that's 3/2 by 1 minus 3/2. And that's 1 minus 3/2, minus 1/2, r to the minus 3. Okay, so if we were to plot this, at large radius, So for objects which are not sufficiently compact to be relativistic, part of the electrons themselves are not relativistic. It goes as m is proportional to r to the minus 3. There's m. Okay. At some point, it becomes relativistic, in which case, so this is non-relativistic, relativistic. At some point, it becomes relativistic. So that's r as 0 divided by minus 2, right? So that's r to the 0, and it levels off. Okay. So that's r to the 0. And this guy is the Chandrasekhar mass. Okay, there's a maximum mass white dwarf you can have, and it's simply because it transitions from being non-relativistic to relativistic. And we can get that there is such a thing just from these scaling arguments. To get the actual value, we have to do a little bit more work. Okay, so that's good. That's one nice qualitative result that jumps right out. Another thing that we might think about would be a neutron star. Okay, a neutron star is degenerate neutrons. Okay, when you compress something sufficiently, degenerate electron pressure is insufficient to hold it up. This is what we're seeing here. There's a maximum mass configuration that could be supported at a given radius. As we continue to compress it, at some point, whatever was holding that up doesn't work anymore. Let me grab another colored chalk. And a couple colors. Finish drawing this diagram. We have exactly the same sort of story. Okay, now it's degenerate neutrons. What really changes is the mass. That changes the radial scale. But this doesn't really change. It still goes as r to the minus 3. And then turns over. Okay, so it still comes up. Now it wants to turn over, except with neutron stars, we also have general relativity. Okay, and general relativity starts to show up and pose itself in an obvious way. There's another line we might put on an M of R plot. Okay, R has to be bigger. The gm over c squared. It has to be bigger than the Schwarzschild radius. If you make a black hole, then you're not a star anymore. Okay, that's linear in this plot. R equals 2 gm by c squared. And you can watch the tracks of neutron stars turn over and fall down. Although I think the mass scale is a little bit wrong here, but this should be a little bit higher. This is a neutron star. This is a white dwarf. Okay, so again, there's a maximum mass and it turns over. Okay, and we're able to motivate a bunch of this with just essentially hand-waving physics. Or power law solutions to hydrostatic equilibrium and a condition that it's not a black hole. Let me finish by mentioning the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. So you know, we all remember Oppenheimer for blowing up cities, and maybe less so for his opposition to blowing up cities afterwards. But he was actually an astrophysicist. And Oppenheimer-Schneider is the pair who took the Schwarzschild solution and made people realize that maybe this wasn't just a crazy thing, that stars could end up this way. Okay, and he also worried about relativistic stars, of course. The point is that we've written this down. Nobody complained. We wrote this down in spherical symmetry for Newtonian gravity and all of that. We came up with some power law solutions, which he didn't complain about because I warned you it was a little fishy, but hey, it will get us what we need in a moment. And then I come over here and I say, but GR tells us something, and I drew a GR line on here. And where the hell is GR in all of this, right? Well, it turns out that you can write down an analog of this hydrostatic equilibrium for spherically symmetric stars in GR. It's not so complicated. And in fact, the TOV equation looks very similar. It's minus G M by R squared epsilon. Okay, so it looks like minus rho G. Right, there's gravitational acceleration. There's some sort of density. So we're done, except we have to define what the funny M is and the funny epsilon is. Okay, so the funny epsilon is the easy one. Let's do that first. This is rho plus P by C squared, okay, divided by 1 minus 2M by R. I'm going to just make C 1 because now it's G and C are 1 because we're being relativistic. So what would have been density has now become an energy density. We have a proper density, but we also have something having to do with the internal stresses. And there's also some redshift factor. If you want to see a derivation, by all means, go look it up in Weinberg or some other reference, but it's effectively just a redshifted energy density that includes the internal stresses. Right? This is the equivalence principle in action. Stress gravitates. So when you're feeling particularly under stress, you weigh more. And then the thing that we would call mass is what you would write down as mass. It's the integral of the rest mass density plus something that integrates up, again, the pressure. That's, again, a statement that stress gravitates. Okay, with those two changes, if you just take those and insert them in, you'll find the traditional form of the T of the equation. Okay, so you can certainly go through this process in full general relativity. And there, I think we've come to a good stopping place, unless you guys want to hang out for another hour. All right. Any questions? Feel like we didn't talk about enough things today? Everyone dead already? All right. No, it was too late.
Well, it's not about this.
No. absolutely. Is this about getting on Titan and all of that?
Yeah, so you emailed me all the like sample scripts?
Yes.
You should I just blast that out?
Please do. Yes, okay. Please do. And if you have more questions about this stuff, ask Susan or Chiamaka because they did this in spades last semester. So they can do it all right.